start us off here, we've got Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of Tama ETF, today's sponsor. Yuri has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios. He co-managed the Magity Fund, where he raised several billions of dollars in assets. And in previous panels, Yuri's input has been extremely insightful, especially from that point of view of investors. So thanks for coming, and as always, for sponsoring our panel, Yuri.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we've got Jennifer Avellaneda, a passionate nuclear energy advocate from a very young age. She's currently a probabilistic risk nuclear engineer at Westinghouse Nuclear, where she guides nuclear engineers through assessments of risk associated with nuclear power plants. She also utilizes her deep expertise on risk analysis in nuclear. Jennifer is dedicated to guiding the public perception of nuclear power by promoting informed decision-making. Very grateful to have you here again to discuss Nuke. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hey, everyone. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Next, we've got Justin Hoon from Uranium Insider. Justin is a leading expert in the uranium investment sector, the founder of Uranium Insider. Justin uses rigorous fundamental and technical analysis to make determinations on uranium companies to project in his Uranium Insider focus list. With an inception-to-date performance nearing 400%, I'm excited to have Justin's unique market vision to discuss how current catalysts may affect the uranium sector as a whole. Welcome, Justin.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming. Next, we've got Energy Bant's Mark Nelson. He is the founder and managing director of Radiant Energy Group and has served as a consultant within the clean energy sector and for environmental organizations. Mark's analysis has been featured in several leading European papers, as well as the New York Times and more. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say today. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And I realize I have not updated that speaker bio in like 4 years. So thanks for reminding me I need to do it.
Next, we've got Yellow Bull, a contrarian investor focused on the uranium markets. They have a bi-weekly newsletter covering important macro developments, uranium news, and much more. Thanks for joining us, Yellow Bull.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to join this panel.
Next, we've got J.R. Majeski, the Chief Program Officer at Curio. With more than two decades of specialized experience in the nuclear energy industry, where he had a focus on major projects and security, as well as the management of spent nuclear fuel storage. Happy to have you today as an advocate of nuclear energy, JR.
Oh, thanks. I'm always willing to be an advocate of the industry that I love.
And we all love to hear it. So as we kind of move along here, let's get a quick backdrop on uranium in the current climate. The uranium market has experienced quite a bit of a downtrend since January of last year, with prices currently floating around $70 to $75 per pound. In early 2024, uranium prices surpassed that $100 per pound mark, driven by increased demand from sectors like artificial intelligence data centers, as well as supply constraints from major producers such as Kazakhstan. Analysts predict, however, that uranium prices could rebound to that $90 to $100 per pound by mid-2025. In addition to this, we've obviously got a transition of power in the White House, and despite his vocal support for uranium and U.S. energy independence, Donald Trump has been quite the opponent to the Green New Deal, a proposed set of policies aimed at directing the U.S. to 100% renewable energies by 2030, citing his concern that it will result in the loss of millions of jobs. Now, that said, and politics notwithstanding, there have been myriad programs and reopening endeavors the world abroad, all attempting to educate on nuclear energy and shift the world at large toward cleaner energy options. So to kind of start us off here, from the investment point of view, what makes uranium kind of a unique investment opportunity compared to other sectors? Yuri, how does Tama monitor the nuclear sector with nukes?
Just to pick up on our ETF's actually VOLT, V-O-L-T, and we try to focus on the electrification trend broadly, with nuclear energy a big part of it. And the idea behind it is to try to find ways of getting exposure to nuclear without taking, I guess, undue risks in certain areas. Lots of parts of the equity market, I would say, are poor to be exposed to the nuclear trend, but actually require a lot of risks, whether it's technological risk or commodity risk. Or the truth is, investing in uranium miners or building a nuclear power plant is extremely expensive. It's hard to do. It's dangerous in many ways. Often leads to questionable geographies. And what Volt does in a selective way is invest in nuclear with a view to kind of more profitable and less risky exposed investments. But if I set the scene more broadly, I think the reason we're having this panel is, and particularly in the kind of final bits of the Biden administration, there's a real push in the US to build more nuclear capacity. And that nuclear demand is coming from, because for the first time in two decades and possibly even more, electricity demand is starting to grow in America. And that growth is coming from areas like data centers and AI, but also the electrification of everything, mobility, digitalization, cryptocurrencies, all of those things are leading a sector that historically has not seen any growth in demand to start to see this sort of 2-5% growth. And that growth is something that we think is going to meet an environment of quite restricted supply and unleash an investment cycle. And nuclear is a major part of that. Why? Nuclear energy is carbon, is very environmentally friendly. It's stable. So unlike other renewable sources of energy, it effectively provides a stable baseload power, which is what is needed in the US market, especially for data centers, which are on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it provides this power in an economically efficient way. And that is something that we think is going to lead to perhaps a new nuclear renaissance in the United States. Now, that term has been thrown around a lot. And as we know, in the last couple of decades, the US had a few different starts and stops related to nuclear power. But we feel this time there's a lot of stars are aligning, particularly this demand driver. The economic reality is going to set in. And that is usually what drives companies to make large capital investments and build nuclear plants. And there's lots of ways to get exposure to it through uranium, but also through new technologies like small-scale nuclear or existing players that are building or rebuilding or turning back on nuclear reactors. And so we think that there are many, many opportunities, and that is what the Volt Fund is focused on finding, but in a profitable and less risky way.
Thank you, Yuri, and apologies for the ETF slip up there. Folks, if you didn't hear Yuri's beginning of his response there, it is Volt, the electrification ETF by Tama. To learn more about that instantly, I've pinned right at the top here some more breakdown of Volt and how Volt is functioning from Yuri himself right up here in the panel nest. So now, for quite some time, just to kind of build on some of that building or rebuilding, there's also been a significant supply-demand imbalance for uranium. And some do still project, like I mentioned at the top of the show here, that we'll see uranium prices above 100 per pound as early as mid-2025 here. So Justin, I'm curious, do you agree with that projection? And then I'd like to hear from Mark and Yuri as well.
I think it's pretty much at this point a foregone conclusion that the pressure on the price is going to be to the upside. I think making price targets, expectations, especially within short-term timeframes, is always a nearly impossible task in this industry. It's a very, very complex, convoluted industry to understand. A lot of moving parts, a lot of different players. But what's really obvious at this point is that there's a enormous and growing demand for uranium. The nuclear industry is set to grow potentially up to 3%+ per year compound annual going out for the next decade and a half, and possibly beyond, hopefully beyond. So we have this enormous growth sector. We have existing reactors, especially in the United States, that are pretty much across the board getting life extensions at this point. We had premature closures as soon as just a few years ago, as recent as a few years ago. That has completely shifted. There's electricity demand is surging. It's been flat for the last almost 20 years in the US, and now it's going up like a hockey stick. So the demand picture is there. Supply is starting to respond, but it's problematic pretty much everywhere. It's coming out of the ground. And mining is very hard. Uranium mining is even harder. So we have this pretty obvious supply and demand picture where the pressure on the price is likely to be to the upside. There's yet to be any sort of evidence of an influx of supply becoming available to the market from any particular source. We also have historically low commercial above ground mobile inventories. So there's always a very large inventory that's held by various players throughout this industry, especially sovereigns and utilities. The fuel cycle to take uranium to fabricated fuel, you know, is 18 to 24 months typically. And so reactor operators will often keep 2 or 3+ years of inventory on hand. So there's at any given time, there's north of a billion and a half pounds just sitting in global inventories. But the mobile above ground inventory, largely that had been coming from secondary supplies, like underfeeding, like downblending of nuclear warheads, these types of secondary inventories available to the market have dwindled down to next to nothing. So any demand that comes in even average volumes right now into the spot or the term market tends to move the price upward. So what we're coming, what we believe to the tail end of is a consolidation period from the early part of last year where the uranium price in the spot market basically doubled. The term market continued to grind higher and utilities were faced with a lot of uncertainties, not only around the election and the now we know incoming new administration, but in the U.S. in particular, the banning of Russian material that went into law in August. And now there's effectively an embargo on Russia's side where the last three shipments coming from Russia that were supposed to have uranium headed to the United States did not have that uranium on those shipments. So we have somewhat of a bifurcated market, a very complicated fuel cycle, but it's pretty clear that there's not an overhang of inventory any longer. Supply side is tight. The demand side is stable and growing. And that's the picture that we find ourselves in. Contrast that with cyclical sentiment signals. This space on the investing side tends to be very emotional to the upside and the downside. Right now, I would argue we are plumbing the lows in terms of sentiment. And going back the 7 years I've been following this sector, when you have RSI pushing down into the 30 range and sentiment absolutely terrible, every single time that's been a very, very positive buy signal. So we think that the valuation of the equities right now is quite compelling considering the demand picture that's ahead of us.
So he's the guy that I would go to for everything that he said. I just want to mention something about, I guess, surprises. Upside and downside surprises in nuclear seem to have a big jerk effect on the prices of the uranium equities. One of the things that I'm paying attention to is that Germany is still negative, negative, negative on nuclear. And the upcoming election, at least looking at it today, does not look like it changes that picture significantly, except for, say, a black swan energy event happening in the next few weeks. So I look at shutoffs and shutdowns of nuclear because they are long expected, and the reversal of those shutdowns, when they happen, are big surprises that send utilities scampering back to try to find fuel if their plans change. Europe is shutting down several nuclear reactors this year into very difficult energy headwinds. If any of those decisions change, it could have a dramatic impact on sentiment. Now, in the United States, and since this is, the theme of this is partly nuclear energy, what to expect under Trump, at the moment, we do not have announcements of expanding nuclear significantly in America. With the advanced reactors, we don't really have big power deals happening that are confident enough that they matter in the short run for uranium. If we had large announcements about significant funding coming to new builds in the United States, which is something that is absolutely possible this year, then I expect that people would see the long-term outlook improve for uranium demand and for nuclear generally.
Thank you, Mark. So I do want to touch on that real quick here. There are a few topics that just came up that I really want to dive into. But first, let's kind of touch a little bit on that notion of, you know, plans for more nuclear energy in the United States. Now, obviously, many have advocated for increasing the U.S. nuclear power share to 50% by 2050 under the Green New Deal. First part of this is kind of how realistic is this goal given the current political and market environment? So first of all, is that 50% nuclear share by 2050 achievable? And then as kind of a tag on to this, with the incoming administration's vocal dissent to the Green New Deal, are there any other potential policies on the horizon that would cover clean energy in the way the Green New Deal projects to? JR, do you care to take this one?
Yeah, I think that the Trump administration is going to be fully focused on unleashing nuclear technology and nuclear power plants. I mean, when you talk about what's on the horizon, you have Vogtle's Unit 4 in Georgia that is supposed to begin its commercial operation in the first quarter, that began the first quarter of 2024. Palisades in Michigan is on track to restart in the fall of this year. Constellation plans on restarting TMI in Pennsylvania by 2028. And you have, you know, TerraPower with Bill Gates. You have my company, Curio. There's Oklo. There's a number of companies that are, you know, highly competitive in the market that want to start up these small modular reactors. Tennessee Valley Authority is also, you know, definitely in the mix. But I think there's, you know, there's significant barriers in place, right? From a regulatory framework, it just costs way too much to build these plants, and it really has to do with, you know, the regulatory burden that's placed on, you know, these licensees. And I think that the Trump administration is very aware of that. I know Chris Wright and, you know, his team that he's putting together have, you know, extensive experience in the nuclear power industry specifically. And I think they're going to be very aware and highly keen on these things. And they're going to look to promote legislation through the Congress that will help us. And, you know, I'm looking for them to do that quite rapidly, to be honest.
Hey, JR, good to meet you on here. I'm going to do a slightly dissenting view, where I would say that almost nobody I've talked to that is focused on the regulatory reform aspects of nuclear has much experience in nuclear. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying I got to push back a little and say that almost everything that I've seen from people with major issues on the regulatory side, with very few exceptions in my entire career, has been people who are new to nuclear and discovering for the first time that it is a tricky and interesting beast of a technology. I'm excited to see what streamlining can do. I think there's a number of things that can speed up permitting and licensing in the US, and I'm excited to see where they lead. I just got to point out that for a number of companies, getting a much smoother and faster regulatory environment is just going to be a license to spend way more of their investor money a lot faster without being able to blame the regulator. It is possible to license full-scale nuclear reactor designs with the NRC for a few tens of millions. You just got to have your ducks in a row and have the technology kind of mastered. The argument for regulatory reform is saying that if we haven't mastered a technology or we don't have experience in it, should we be able to go really fast? And I think that that's something we proved we could do in the 1950s and 60s. It's just it didn't really produce that many good nuclear plant designs. It's the only thing. Okay, putting that little thing aside, Unusual Whales, I brought up a colleague from London who, to my knowledge, is the only one who's done detailed polling of United States sentiment on nuclear, both immediately before and immediately after the election. And he had some good stuff and some bad stuff that I wanted to spend 60 seconds to share, if you don't mind me having Richard Ollington pipe in before he has to retire for the evening over in the UK.
Yeah, please do.
Great, thank you. So for context, we've got data from 24,000 US respondents. And what we've seen is that actually, disappointingly, public support for nuclear has dropped slightly since the election. And where that drop seems to come from is mainly amongst the Democratic voters. So you could make up the theory that, you know, they have less faith in the Republican Party doing nuclear the way they want nuclear to be managed. But the positive side is Republicans in power. If you look amongst the Republican voters, which is their preferred source of clean energy? So we asked them about nuclear, wind, solar, gas with carbon capture, and also biomass. By far, nuclear is the most preferred clean energy source amongst those Republican voters. So looking forward at what this new administration might do, if they're going to listen to their voter base, it looks like they will continue to support nuclear and maybe even improve upon what the Democratic Party did for nuclear the last few years.
Thank you, Richard. Really good backdrop to have there. JR, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I just want to say that I fundamentally agree with what Mark was saying. My point is that, you know, Trump is still in the process of building out his administration with respect to the Department of Energy. I know he just announced the deputy secretary, and I know there's some quite broad discussion on who's going to take over NE. And there are quite a few undersecretaries that I think are going to add value that will probably, I mean, it's not going to solve the issue. I think Mark's hesitation is spot on, but you know, I do still maintain a positive outlook. I hope that the focus maintains on nuclear and we don't fall under the mirage of oil and gas like we have in the past. That's my biggest fear.
The one thing I would just add to that is, you've probably seen, and I know it's the outgoing administration, and we're talking here about Trump administration, and things might change, but there was a big paper put out right at the end of the, a couple of weeks ago, about an official target of trying to add an enormous amount of nuclear capacity in the US. I think it was something like 200 gigawatts. So the US is planning to add 60 times more nuclear capacity in the next 25 years than they've added in the last century. And there are real plans. They're very, very ambitious targets. I don't know if those are going to be kept. And of course, there needs to be a move by industry, technical expertise, and regulatory expertise to get all of that kind of nuclear done. But the target is there within the Department of Energy. The question is whether it's going to be adopted by the new administration or not, of course, remains an open one. But I do think that there is a move, and it's quite unprecedented to put out such an ambitious target in the nuclear industry.
So I want to touch on one thing that JR mentioned there, that being the Vogtle unit. So last year, the U.S. saw its first construction of new nuclear units in over, I think, 30 years it was, such as those Vogtle units 3 and 4. And so I'm curious, moving forward, what have we seen since those two openings, and what kind of significance is a milestone like this as we move forward into a new administration, new targets for clean energy? Let's start with Jennifer here. What do you expect to see, or what have you seen since we last spoke? And then I want to spin to Yuri about what you're watching in Volt in regards to new plant operations coming to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely from what I've read so far, Trump has indicated basically a strong focus on building small modular reactors. And this, obviously, in order to lower the energy cost and also the cost for construction and the time for building these type of projects. And why do I mention this? Strictly also because you brought up Vogtle. So the, let's call it the issue with large-scale reactor projects, it's because they usually face funding challenges, even without the direct government subsidies, right? So nuclear has one of the, let's call it, pretty important challenges, which is the financial and also licensing processes time, because it is actually time-consuming. So I could have all the money in the world right now, and I could have a pretty location for my next AP1000 reactor, which is similar to Vogtle 3 or Vogtle 4. And the licensing process that it would take, the time that it would take me to get a yes from the administration or from the government or from the NRC, could take years. So that is also one of the problems. I could have professionals in the line. I could have the space. I could have the location. But in order to even start building a large-scale reactor, supposing that I'm going to be proposing a model already approved, could take years in the making. So in that side, I'm really expecting from the Trump administration to probably give a little bit more of light or focus, or even give a little bit more of budget to the NRC and more workers in order to have less licensing times. So this way, operators and also companies that are in charge of, you know, building and planning all of these large scale reactor projects could face less timing in design and also less timing in starting building up these type of things. Next, and I know I also just quickly mentioned the small modular reactors. I'm very excited to see when are they coming to life, to put it that way, because we also need to, you know, with the new scale example, everybody was really excited, like, yeah, we're about to have a soon to be small modular reactor, and this is going to be like the first one, because, you know, in nuclear industry, nobody wants to be the first one. Everybody wants to be the second one. And that's also an issue. So NuScale was putting up an example and everybody was very excited. And at the end of everything, they decided to cancel the project, right? So I'm also very scared that this will continue to happen, even though projects like small modular reactors will start having like the backup and the push with Trump's administration. So I think we'll need to see if he's going to step in and start working on regulations and in order to promote the development of both large scale SMRs and even micro reactors. That's also another project that had me very, very excited. But I guess we'll see. All we have right now are words, and I'm very looking forward to start seeing action.
Well said. So I want to touch on something there. We've seen this year and late last year a lot of engagement from the private sector, as it were. We've got companies like Google, Amazon, I think even Microsoft, investing hundreds of millions of dollars into production, into partnerships. And so, Yuri, my question for you on this, especially in relation to how Volt is being managed and kind of scoping out where to place its investments, do we expect to see more from the private and public company sectors? Who else is kind of making a hallmark transition like this toward nuclear energy investment?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most interesting developments. It's maybe a little bit different from previous nuclear renaissance. We're not seeing, and we are obviously also seeing, but we're seeing for the first time quite a large demand for what's called co-location of power. Effectively, companies like Microsoft and Google are realizing that the data center demands for power are vast. And the word in the street around Silicon Valley is that is the real constraint for deploying at scale, you know, artificial intelligence, that power is the problem. And if you spend a bit of time, I mean, it's interesting that data centers are actually, the way they're sort of scaled and measured, their size is measured in power units. You know, they're measured in gigawatts. And it's interesting that that's the real constraint. And if you spend a bit of time reading about how data centers look, you realize that, one, they use a lot of power, but the sort of improvements in terms of power has flatlined. So the equipment was getting more efficient, but now it's not anymore. And we're adding more and more power-hungry chips from NVIDIA that use a ton of memory and processing power that need a lot of powering, especially for both the computing equipment, but as well as cooling. So you have these vast data centers, and we all know a ChatGPT query is just a lot more energy intensive than, you know, searching on Google or other ways of searching for information. And what they're realizing is, okay, how do we start to solve that problem? Also, how do we get ahead of our competitors? And one of the ways to do that is to try to co-locate data centers with already pre-existing power. And I think the most prime example of last year was when Microsoft assigned this deal with the Three Mile Island reactor, not the one that melted down, but the one that remained, and to try to recommission that. And these companies are committing real CapEx, and then in the end will sign energy deals on that side. And I think that's a real driver for the nuclear industry as well. Now, there are host of problems with this, of course, because regulators don't really like co-location of power, because what they see is a way for effectively bypassing some of the other costs that go into the utility bills that people pay. And that, I think, is going to be an interesting test case. And the test case we've already had has actually not gone in favor of co-location. But the demand is still there. And I think that's one of the key drivers of how we're looking at the investment landscape. We think the demand will be there. And if you look at companies like NuScale, you know, the reality is we need new designs. We need to be able to deploy this power, but it will take time. And so when you're trying to think of it from an investment perspective, I mean, I remember reading about the NuScale reactor, the reactors. I mean, I think the first application was accepted in 2017. I mean, we're in 2025. So that took 8 years to get approved. I think it was approved last year. And so So you know, 7-8 years. And so if the new designs are going to take this long, we have a real problem, because the targets I mentioned before are, and this colocation demand, it's happening now. Demand is starting to grow for the first time this year. And the target of adding this extra nuclear capacity is for 2050, so in the next 25 years. And the way we're approaching this from an investment perspective is to look for and appreciate some of these challenges the nuclear industry has faced in the past. Regulation being one, so going for companies where they're closer to approval of designs, like a NuScale. Yes, the project was canceled, but the reality is you have that design and it's been approved. Looking for companies that have been working in this industry for a very long time that are under the radar. You know, companies like BWX, you know, they've been working on servicing the nuclear fleet for the Navy within some of the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and things like that, and are transitioning to helping with nuclear power and commercial reactors. Or even companies like GE or Emerson that have been involved in the electrification value chain that have exposure to nuclear and have nuclear engineers on staff and are understanding that. That to us seems like a very good way to get exposure to the nuclear sector without taking a lot of undue technical risk. The technical risk is going to take time, and the regulation is unfortunately going to also take time. There are definitely moves to reduce it, but again, the reality is one of it takes a lot of time. So that's how our approach to this. But we think it's an exciting chapter that's going to unfold over the next decade or two in terms of this demand picture and the economic reality of all of these things.
Thank you, Yuri. So I do want to touch on demand here now, specifically the constraints of supply and demand. So this month, and this is pretty notable, and I imagine most folks on the panel might have something to chime in on here. So I'm going to start off with Justin on this one, and then please feel free to chime in, everyone. So this month, Kazatomprom of Kazakhstan, the world's largest uranium producer, announced a suspension of uranium production at its Inkai joint venture due to what they called, quote, a bureaucratic holdup. Now, given Kazakhstan's severe importance as a uranium producer, what kind of consequences may production holdups like this have in the wider nuclear markets? Now, Justin, I know you've written about this Inkai situation. I would love if you could shed a little bit of light on that situation, what consequences might be seen, and then I'd love to kick this one around the panel as well.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, just right off the top, you have to sort of take the news release at face value for what it is, right? That's the same response that Grant Isaac from Cameco had stated in a panel with a Goldman Sachs conference last week, that they just have to take their partner's word for it, that this is what is happening. To give a little bit more historical context, the joint venture between Cameco and Kazatomprom goes all the way back to 1996. So we're talking almost 30 years of partnership here. This is the best, especially Block 3 of Inkai, this is the best ISR project in the world. The Inkai joint venture is expected to produce its nameplate, which is somewhere to the tune of 8 million pounds of uranium per year, for the next 25 years. I mean, this is an unbelievable asset. And to preface this latest development with the temporary halt due to this bureaucratic detail, going back to their first half of the year 2024 reporting that happened in August, Inkai's production was down 20% year over year, which was a little bit of a head scratcher. Now, there seemed to be some problems with sulfuric acid availability. Why it affected this project in particular is a little bit more tricky to nail down. It's our understanding that Cameco has not wanted to inject Russian sulfuric acid into their joint venture deposit. Cameco has also not wanted to ship material back to Canada from the port of St. Petersburg. They've elected voluntarily to ship the material west via the Caspian route, which has been slightly problematic, much, much slower, much more expensive. So Cameco's presence in the country, while it is very, very long standing, certainly is hitting some speed bumps. The company, you could hear the frustration in their voice when they discussed the emergence of the new mineral extraction taxes that were announced last year that are much, much higher than historically they have been, which was a surprise to Cameco. So it's a little bit of a black box. We don't exactly know what is going on, but any sort of supply interruption for the world's best ISR project is certainly notable. Just 30,000 foot view, Kazakhstan is going to continue to be the biggest producer in the world. We model out for them to be able to incrementally increase production year over year. With that said, we're going to see their 2024 reporting, their operation and trading update on February 3rd. That should give us some detail on their production. We believe their production for 2024 is going to come in on the low side of the range. And then, of course, the market always awaits their 2025 and potentially 2026, although I don't think they're going to give that until August. So their updated expectations for production for this year is what the market's going to be waiting for. But they'll continue to be the biggest player. I think, honestly, the biggest story out of Kazakhstan really is kind of the bifurcation within the country. More and more uranium produced there is going to end up in Russia and China, period, full stop. So the bulk of the demand, 70% of the nuclear demand of the world, is in the OECD countries. And China and Russia are going to be consuming more and more of what comes out of that country. So things are looking less reliable for Western supply. Let's just say that.
I think something to add to what Justin said expertly as well is that in such a bifurcated market that we're seeing right now, we're going to need a lot more investments, not just in a, well, only in a Western nuclear fuel secure cycle. So that starts with physical uranium. And when people look at the price of uranium, as of course gone up a lot at the very start of the conversation, you noted that the spot price of uranium was very volatile. It got to $106 in January of last year, and then it kind of dropped to around the mid $70 range right now. But the real price to watch is the term market, which is where 75 to 80% of all activity takes place. And that price has gone up consistently upwards and to the right for years now, ever since it bottomed in 2016. And a lot of people would be forgiven for looking at the at this price and thinking, okay, we must have reached an equilibrium price level right now that would incentivize enough Western production to come online. But if anything, not only do we need a higher price to incentivize a new production after such a long bear market, what we perhaps need even more is time. Because after such a long bear market, we have seen an incredible amount of intellectual capital leave this sector. And it is not easy to build and run a uranium mine, just like it's not easy to build and run a nuclear power plant. So this intellectual capital that is simply not there needs to be reaffirmed and needs to be made sure that we have adequate amount of investments into that Western uranium production capacity. And I think we will definitely see that. And as the saying goes with commodities, the cure for high price is high prices. But I don't think we are anywhere near an equilibrium price level right now. And I think that we have a lot more time left to go. And just to finish my thought on this, I think that one of the most important drivers in getting more Western capacity online will be incentive from utilities to sign new long-term contracts, because these long-term contracts, unlike any other commodity, they give these producers certainty. Because if you sign a 10-year contract agreement for a certain price of uranium where the producer in question knows that they will make profit, that they will know they can keep their mine in operation, that will give them the certainty they need to then finance that mine, keep it in operation. And I think that this year will be the first year where we once again see what we call a replacement rate contracting cycle, which is where you see basically what the entire world consumes in terms of primary demand being contracted into long-term contracts. And historically speaking, these replacement rate contracting years, just like in the last bull market and the one before that, will be the times where the price of uranium goes up the most. Last year, it went up nearly 20% on, I say only, it's of course a huge amount, but it went up 20% on only 106.2 million pounds being signed into long-term contracts. If this year we see 180 to 200 million, if that goal is reached, I think the price will respond and will respond strongly.
Beautifully said. So I want to touch a little bit. Obviously, we've tickled the topic of more investment needed and more dedication from the international community to kind of push toward nuclear energy more. And to that end, last year, numerous countries, I think six additional countries, signed on to the tripling nuclear energy capacity by 2050 declaration. So a bit of a two-parter here. Is this goal possible given the current climate surrounding nuclear energy, that triple by 2050? And as a sort of follow-up to that, with the expansion of uranium mining in countries like Canada and Australia, how do ETFs like Volt evaluate the growth potential of smaller emerging uranium producers compared to those established giants like Cameco? Let's start with Yuri and then kick it to Mark.
Yeah, I think you have to be very careful in the uranium mining space because, as the other panelists have mentioned, mining itself is very dangerous. It's very capital intensive, and particularly uranium mining is actually quite difficult to do. So many of the times that we look at companies, what we find sadly is a lot of loss-making businesses that aren't necessarily the ones that you want to be exposed to because the nuclear renaissance itself is already, you're carrying quite a lot of risks, you know, regulatory risks, technical, political, all of those things. And the question is whether you want to layer on top of that risks related to mining as well. And so what we often, the temptation is to at least in these periods where you're having a lot of change going on and a lot of push from government officials to be in companies and segments of the nuclear space that are less risky. And then you can evaluate it. I can't remember which one of the speakers said this, but you know, in many respects, it's like building nuclear reactor designs. You want to be second, not first, because first often things happen. And if you spend a bit of time studying the history of the nuclear industry and the uranium industry, that there's a lot of problems that happen, and the risks dominate the return profiles for sure. And so you have to be careful about that exposure. And so you want to use active management. You want to look at the quality of the businesses exposed to this trend. Are they run by management teams who've been there through these different cycles? Do they know how to manage capital well? Have they got the right funding? Because in many cases, you're facing a CapEx bill for a long period of time. And I think, you know, it's telling that even the leaders, and here I'll talk about more about the nuclear construction rather than uranium mining, are diversifying their revenue bases because maybe they see some of these risks. So if you look at a company like Constellation Energy, a leader in the nuclear space in the US as a utility, their recent very, very large deal is actually adding gas capacity. And I thought that was quite an interesting move from essentially a nuclear player. And so I think people are looking at it with excitement in this industry, but in many ways you have to be cognizant of the risks. And that's the way we approach it. A big dose of skepticism, and especially when you look at some of the smaller miners and projects that are being discussed, that they don't look to us as that attractive at this stage. That would be our view from a Volt perspective.
Hey, and so I'm actually helping arrange the triple nuclear declaration and country thing. So it's sort of a baby of mine that I care a lot about. And one of the challenges we've gotten, some people say triple isn't enough. Renewables are trying to triple by 2030. Other people are saying, this is ridiculous. I like nuclear, but I don't think we can hit these targets. Triple by 2050 was chosen as a goal that some countries are literally doing now. Like China is the biggest country. They are literally tripling within, I guess, 15 years or so. Other countries like ours with the biggest fleet today are not at the moment moving in a way that would meet the triple nuclear goal. And it'd be very hard to get a global triple nuclear without America doing at least, say, doubling. The answer is, it is an aggressive but real goal if we can learn to build our reactor designs as well as China learned how to build our reactor designs. I'm not saying we'll hit them as cheaply as China, but I will say that we can do it as fast if we take advantage of the modular construction that the leading large reactor models are designed to be built with modules. If we do that properly, and I do think we, for all the changes that may be helpful for novel designs in the regulatory environment in America, we have a very good environment in America for existing designs. And the problems at Vogtle, I've heard from experts I trust absolutely on this, that the regulatory issue was not top 10. It is about getting a compelling argument together with both public and private capital, public and private financing, public and private utilities, if I'm being loose with the terms. In other words, the large vertically integrated utilities and the groups like Constellation that, as you saw, as mentioned, just bought gas in order to scale up capacity because they couldn't rely on nuclear doing it in time. Yes, it's a real but tough goal. And one of the things I'm most excited about in 2025 is seeing the first steps towards democracies like America being in a position to act on that goal.
And you did, you brought up China's potential prospective capacity in the future based on their current endeavors. I think the United States, it was the current highest operating capacity at just above 100 gigawatts, whereas China has prospective capacity of 118. And so I know one hang-up that we've seen in Europe, especially in Germany, like Mark mentioned earlier, is just that fear around nuclear energy. I know when Germany started kind of gutting, for lack of a better word, its nuclear energy plants, the main cited concern was that of the Fukushima incident. And so, Jennifer, if you don't mind, could you kind of give some backdrop to the modernization of nuclear power plants, the safety therein, to kind of dispel some of that fear that many in the public may still hold?
Yeah, definitely. I must admit that this is one of my favorite questions, to be honest. Anything related to risk and safety. So first of all, none of the previous events that had happened around the nuclear energy industry could actually happen again because of two main things. And that's how I like to summarize it. Probably there are many more information, but I like to summarize it into two main things. The first one being the design within the plants and also the reactors that were involved in those events. And I call those events being Three Mile Island, Fukushima Daiichi, Chernobyl. All of those events, none of them right now actually represent the design and operating status that the current nuclear power plants are operating as for right now. And second, there is something that us as an industry, and that is something that I like very, very much, is that we have, like, let's call it a program called Operating Experience, in which every plant actually share mitigating and risk information regarding any type of maintenance, testing, operability events, refueling outage events, and any type of things that they would like to share with others in order for us to try to, in case we face them, mitigate in the same way, or even being a step ahead of any type of those problems that we could encourage depending on the status of the plant. So we are always many steps ahead regarding any potential problems that a certain plant could be under. So as for right now, I can certainly tell anyone who asks about safety and risk analyses that current nuclear power plants that are, according to their designs and their operability as for right now, are 99% safe. Why do I say 99 and not 1%? Because we also need to take into consideration the human availability and human abilities in order to operate these type of plants. There's no such thing as 100% safe, but we are the safest source of electricity and energy that are currently existing right now in the world.
And just kind of like a tag onto that, Jennifer, how have things like new developments in automation at nuclear plants had an effect on safety?
Well, I'm not gonna lie, it has been definitely been challenging because we, as for safety and risk analysis, are facing what I like to call the chicken and the egg, right? Because in order to kind of introduce a good overview and a good reporting regarding the potential mitigation impacts and also risk impacts, we need to have a pilot. But in order to build up a pilot, we need to have a safety and risk assessment, right? So we are kind of working towards, and when I say we, I'm obviously only speaking on my point of view, but not representing Westinghouse at all. But what we are trying to do right now is to, while we are building a certain design or a certain pilot, we are at the same time working on the safety and mitigation measurements. Has that changed? Speaking strictly about doing a comparison between the AP1000, which is the newest type of reactor built in the United States, Vogtle Unit 3 and 4, and comparing it with the proposed small modular reactor, which is AP300, they have a lot of similarities. So regarding the safety and risk assessments, we can, let's call it, guide better ourselves because we already have experience with a similar type of reactor. So I don't see them as challenges. I see it more of an opportunity to make it faster in order to, you know, start building, start designing, start requesting for licensing.
So one other safety concern that's been voiced has been that surrounding spent fuel storage. So like quote unquote nuclear waste, the runoff, the byproducts, as it were, of generating nuclear energy. Now, JR, you've had some experience as well with storage of those spent fuels. What can you say to how storage is taking place and the safety therein of storage of spent fuels, JR?
So right now, the licensees in the United States are storing, predominantly storing their spent nuclear fuel in canisters on site on their what's called an ISPC, which is a interim spent fuel storage installation. And there's a significant push in a multitude of ways. So there are some industry advocates that are petitioning the states and federal government to allow them to build and operate a consolidated spent fuel storage location. And that would house the majority of spent nuclear fuel across the United States. So that would require the transport of these canisters to whatever sublocation is chosen. And obviously Yucca Mountain is sounding as if it's not going to move forward. I think the Trump administration, from what I've been told, has plans on canceling that and finalizing that cancelization. But then you have, you know, other proponents in the industry, such as, you know, my company that would like the United States to move into recycling and reprocessing this spent nuclear fuel. I think there's a significant opportunity to do that. And right now my company is working with the Department of Energy and multiple national labs across the country and other partners in the industry to prove the technology and hopefully, you know, bring it to the forefront here in the U.S. I think spent nuclear fuel is, I mean, we're pulling this fuel out of the reactor with 96% of its energy potential remaining, and we're just throwing it into canisters and storing it on site. And while it's safe, I mean, it obviously has a shelf life, and there are other countries that are performing this process. France is probably the leader, and you know, we've developed a technology that, you know, we can recycle this fuel, draw many of the isotopes that, you know, aren't necessarily focused on, and you know, provide an opportunity for us to, you know, not be as dependent on foreign sources of fuel to power these reactors.
Thank you, JR. So I want to spin back to Europe here. France, actually, JR brought up France there. They just announced finalization of funding to expand their nuclear energy, but we've still seen evidence of countries in Europe continuing to shut plants down. And so I want to start with Yuri and then kick it to Mark here. What else are we seeing kind of in that theater of Europe toward expansion or de-expansion of nuclear energy? Do we project them to, you know, continue jump-starting as we're seeing in some places like the miners in Canada, like the miners in Australia, or are we going to see a continued reliance in Europe or throughout Europe on energy from Russia as opposed to moving forward with this nuclear energy push?
Yeah, it's there's a lot of things to untangle in that question. I think it's interesting. There's definitely a move in Europe to more energy independence. I think after a couple of years of still relying on Russian gas, I think there is a trajectory of travel. There was a recent communique starting to possibly move to banning Russian gas, but it's a difficult situation. The transformations in European industry have been short of miraculous in many cases, especially in the German industrial base, maintaining industrial production while decreasing the use of gas. It's an interesting kind of test experiment, if you will. But I think that it has to happen. There has to be a diversification of energy sources. I think the reality is, especially if you were to provide baseload power, other renewable sources, they just don't cut the bill. They're highly variable. Storage is a problem. The projects themselves, you know, they can be efficient, but it's still costly. And nuclear power definitely offers an alternative. And I do think the political relationship with nuclear power is slightly bizarre. I mean, we were talking about Germany earlier. But, I mean, some of the things that I've read in the past, it's just, you know, in Germany, their reactors are very close by in France. So effectively, they're okay with, you know, French building the reactors, and the risk is still there, but somehow just across the river, you can't build one in Germany. And this the story, of course, of Austria that spent years building a nuclear reactor and then just shut it down on its first day of operations is telling. But I do think it's difficult to see the environment changing and this perception of nuclear power, you know, coming into vogue. But perhaps the environmental push is going to be the thing that does it. And I do feel underlying there that is one of the potential big drivers, that we need stable renewable power, and nuclear is the best alternative for that. One of the most remarkable statistics that I read the other day was a paper that estimated that, yes, the Chernobyl disaster was terrible and in many ways caused the deaths of thousands of people. But actually, if you look at the shift away from nuclear power and into dirty sources of power like coal, probably killed millions of people through air pollution and those kinds of effects. And this paper is trying, I think that's the reality. And nuclear design is a lot safer than it was before. None of those nuclear reactors, as was being said, are in operation. So I think that it has to be part of the solution in the future. But everything that we see, we don't see enough impetus from the political authorities to resolve the situation. And Germany, I think, is the leading kind of country that would need to do that, because they're the biggest energy consumer. They're at the center of all of this, and they need to get it right. And that's the thing. Against this, by the way, I think one of the other telling things is that if you look at projections of, for example, LNG export capacity out of the United States, by 2028, that's going to double again. And there's definitely a political drive in the US to continue to perhaps build nuclear to take care of your own energy independence, but then drive kind of LNG export markets and keep Europe exposed to gas. And so all of these considerations come in. But in terms of how we're looking at investments, we think the US is actually taking this quite seriously, and not just because it's home to the large technology companies, but even things like reshoring, which we've talked about before in this forum, you know, and there's a real rebuilding of US industry, and electricity is a big part of it, and is needed to unlock those industries, especially if they're modern industries with automation. And I'm not even getting to electric vehicles, et cetera. I think the US is quickly becoming a big market for electric vehicles as well. And Europe's just falling behind. So it's difficult to see interesting investment opportunities with Europe at their core until some of these situations are resolved.
I just wanted to mention something about this. France is underproducing from their existing nuclear plants. The goal of adding new nuclear plants is sort of disconnected from actually increasing nuclear power. If anything, they're by saying they want to build new power plants but not increase capacity or output, it's a very confused situation. And since France is the leader on nuclear energy in Europe in many ways, their internal confusion about what the heck they're trying to do and how they are even planning on blending subsidized renewables with their nuclear, it's a very confusing situation. At the moment, France seems absolutely dedicated to expensive nuclear. That is, not reducing the cost of nuclear power to industries. French nuclear power costs at least double American nuclear power to generate, even though there's very similar plant designs, staffed with similar numbers of people. If anything, wages are a little lower in France. It's just they are deeply confused after 20 years of both anti-nuclear and pro-nuclear efforts in, you know, flip-flopping between different governments, and deep confusion about what the purpose is of electricity as either a vehicle for economic growth on one side or a vehicle for ideological warfare against themselves on the other. So I have deep concerns about France, but I think that they at least acknowledge that nuclear is good, which is a major step forward about 4 years ago when the current leadership of France said that nuclear should be reduced. And now they say it shouldn't. So that's good. That's progress. It's just we need better performance from France, in my opinion, to feel optimistic about cheap nuclear electricity helping the overall economic situation improve in Europe, as opposed to status quo, expensive existing nuclear augmented by distant, slow future new build nuclear. So I know that sounds like kind of negative, but France is the greatest nuclear country in the world. And I think we can hold them to a different standard for what they can achieve versus other countries. I think that Germany is staring down a situation of fairly catastrophic collapse of their industries. Turning nuclear back on couldn't reverse it all, but it's one of the only wild cards that pays for itself and makes available exactly the right type of energy in an extremely short period of time. It doesn't mean they're going to make the right decision, but if they do it, it is bullish for all of Europe. A number of smaller countries in Europe are absolutely committing to nuclear, at least rhetorically, and we hope to see that backed by action. So Netherlands, for example, is a country that's crucial to European energy supply by being one of the largest import locations for the LNG that is replacing Russian pipeline gas. They are looking at not just being only a natural gas battery storage and import and transfer terminal for all of Europe. They are looking at nuclear. If Netherlands can make serious progress on a nuclear program over the next year, I think that's very positive for European energy in general. At the moment, though, boy, it's very hard as an American to look over at Europeans, you know, desperately seeking out our natural gas and still barely able to keep up their own industries.
Really good insight there, Mark. Thank you. What I want to do here is I kind of want to kick around the panel and just touch on a few topics you feel we lacked on today, or anything, any initiatives you're working on or privy to kind of get the audience today more involved, for those who are interested, more involved in kind of looking through potential investments in the future, or even just advocacy for cleaner energy. So let's start off here with Justin, and then we'll spin this around.
Yeah, I think we had a decent coverage here. I think one of the elements that is quite disruptive that I don't think the market is giving enough attention to, because they haven't seen a follow-on move in the spot price, for example, is what's going on with the Russian embargo of EUP shipments to the United States. Now, technically, that material can and be sold to other areas of the world, and it will be, right? So that frees up that material. But what the detail on this is that United States utilities that may have to cover this enrichment that is not going to be provided by Russia, they'll have to buy that from Western sources. That would be Urenco or Orano, and they're going to have to pay not only a lot more for the SWU, for the separative work unit, or the cost of enrichment, but it'll be higher tails assays, which means more uranium feedstock. And one other kind of interesting note on this is that the Russians uniquely allow for return feedstock. If you buy enrichment from Russia, they will actually provide that enriched uranium as the product of that service, and you send them the feedstock, the UF6, in return after the fact. Now, that is exactly opposite of the Western providers. So if you have an enrichment contract with Urenco, for example, you're going to have to provide that feedstock up front. So this puts a pretty significant squeeze, potentially, on the spot conversion, spot UF6, and spot uranium markets. Now, we haven't seen any reaction to this yet in the market, and I believe that's because, A, the first shipments that were missed were basically during the holiday season. Everybody's at home with their families, not on their screens. And B, we have some overhanging uncertainties around the incoming Trump admin that I believe U.S. utilities and to some extent other Western utilities as well are sort of waiting on the sidelines to see exactly what the Trump admin is going to be implementing, not only with trade policies, but also with new nuclear or nuclear supportive policies, whether that's in place of the IRA or in addition to, we don't know. So these are a lot of uncertainties that are overhanging the market right now that will come to pass very, very soon. I think that unlocks some ability for U.S. utilities to act and to cover off their uranium needs, which is going to be a driver for higher prices in the next, probably by the end of the first half of this year, in my estimation.
Well said, Justin. And again, thank you so much for coming and lending your takes today, man.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer, anything to add here to send our audience off into the ether of the afternoon?
Yeah, definitely. And thank you so much again for having me. So kind of concluding thoughts right now is that as we discuss, let's call it the evolving landscape of nuclear energy, specifically under this new leadership and administration regarding also the variable global challenges, I believe it is clear that, let's call it collaboration, innovation, and proactive strategies will certainly be key to, you know, navigate in the near future for at least the energy industry within the U.S. So for our country, for the U.S., in order to fully capitalize on nuclear energy potential, and let's say both as clean energy solution and also kind of a cornerstone for energy security, and I do believe we mentioned energy, energy independence. So I believe that we need to focus in four priorities, or let's call it key areas in which anybody listening right now could, you know, enter in and also support and try to reach out to our representatives, our senators, and try to ask questions to make notes. So number one would certainly be strengthening supply chain, right? So it is my belief that addressing vulnerabilities in uranium mining, enrichment, and also advanced fuel production, both domestically and also globally, it is essential for ensuring a resilient energy future, specifically talking also about nuclear, right? So the second one, it's investing in innovation. We quickly talk about SMRs as microreactors or any type of advanced nuclear technologies must have transformative opportunities. Most of the times, we only talk about renewables getting all the investing opportunities, right? But we also need to take a look at nuclear. Nuclear is here with technology that has been developed ever since 1950s. So we have the ability to operate, to design, to start building. So let's keep pushing that. And probably these type of solutions will also make the market faster. And the third one, and I won't be that long. So improving public perception. I always like to mention that one because I see the nuclear energy industry with three important pillars, which is the politics, the economics, and social. So we need to build trust among all of those three in order to have a friendly nuclear energy market. And last but not least, well, balancing policy and actions, right? We have a lot of words right now. We have a lot of guidance and instructions and questioning the new administration. Well, we'll see according to their actions. So, well, that's how I see the success of nuclear energy, not only depending on technological advancements, but also on our ability to collaborate as a country across the borders, industries, and also ideologies. So that's my take. And thank you so, so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for coming. Always great to have you here. JR, anything to add here at the tail end?
Yeah, I mean, I think that President Trump has a unique opportunity here with his administration. And, you know, there's some things that I'd like to see him do. And, you know, just as a segue, you know, I'd like to see him streamline the licensing and permitting processes for the new nuclear builds. I mean, under his first term, he had NEMA. And, you know, that aided to reform the NRC's fee structure and streamline licensing for the advanced reactor designs. I think you need to, you know, ensure that is repolished, refocused, and expanded upon. Reinstating the loan guarantee programs that he had for new nuclear projects. In his first term, the DOE finalized, I think it was like $12 billion in loan guarantees for Vogtle. And I'd like to see that expanded as well. But, you know, the other things would be encouraging, you know, public and private sector partnerships that would help us accelerate innovation and deployment of these advanced reactors. I think there's an opportunity for collaboration between the government and those people that are willing to put their capital up to help overcome some of the technological and financial barriers that exist. And finally, I would say that, you know, supporting nuclear recycling, nuclear spent fuel recycling, I think that is an opportunity. I would encourage all of your listeners out there to check out my company, Curio. There are a number of others that are out there, but I think we're definitely leading the way. And I think nuclear recycling is the future. I think one of the biggest weights around our neck is the waste issue. And, you know, I'd like to solve that for future generations. And that's it. Thank you for having me.
Well said, JR, and thank you for coming. Mark.
Yes, so one of the big ones for me, and I really appreciate what JR said about the role of the US government in loans, even if we have private companies building nuclear. One of the efforts I'm involved with is the nuclear company. We are attempting to actually build China-style, repeat standardized builds of, just like China does, American reactors that are already designed and licensed. One of the things that we need to move forward is to get enough utilities, reactor vendors, engineering firms, and the US government and US states all on the same page for who would go first, second, and third among utilities receiving reactors and states getting nuclear, and then what the backing level is from the federal government for the low-cost financing that will help us compete against China on the cost of nuclear new build. So I am cautiously optimistic, and we'll have a lot of interesting and positive news to share after Trump takes the office, but you know, it's still a lot of work to be done. And then I also have a few advanced reactor companies that I'm more involved with or pay closer attention to, because they included me in the beginning, and I've been able to follow progress. Although I generally think that advanced reactors are going to be shockingly expensive electricity at first, there is some decent realm to get that price down, and especially for specialist use. I think that there's going to be as much potential as some of the boosters say, even though I'm generally more bearish on advanced nuclear than many nuclear commenters in this space. So I've got a few of those I'm paying attention to that I'm excited about. I'm really excited about the nuclear company and potential to do series build of large reactors. And I'm excited to see if we can capture the momentum on the narrative side, the public side that Jennifer has worked so hard on and loves to talk about. I'm excited to see if we can capture that public wave of support in this window that has been thrown open for us by rising electricity demand. A lot of work ahead.
The nuclear company is going to be one to watch. I know Joe Kletcher personally, and he is a fantastic leader. And I've had some engagement with him, and I think they are going to be a game changer.
Yellow Bull, anything you have to say here from that investor point of view that folks should be aware of?
I think we all want Justin already know it. I have one more thing to add, which is with regards to one of the catalysts to look out for before we see more term contracting and more, I guess, a response from the equities that would go with that, is not just the clearing of uncertainty, but also the clearing of prevailing bottlenecks. So we kind of have these fuel cycle bottlenecks in place right now, with Russia, of course, having their place in the market with 44% of the world's uranium enrichment capacity. But without that on the side of Western nations, what we're looking at right now is sort of the way that these utilities get their nuclear fuel is from the back end to the front end. So they don't start with physical uranium, they end with physical uranium, which means they need things like conversion and enrichment and fuel fabrication first. So what we need to look out for uranium investors is for a near-term expansion of more conversion enrichment capacity. So what we're looking at right now is that for example, Orano and Chemical are leading the charge here. So you have Orano, which in France has expressed confidence in achieving 13,000 to 14,000 tons of uranium in the near term in terms of capacity. So in this context, tons of uranium, TU, refers to metric tons of uranium, which is a standard measurement of amount of natural uranium contained within the given material. So typically this material is in the form of uranium hexafluoride, or UF6, as more people will know it. And in this context, one metric ton is around 2,200 pounds. So what we're seeing right now is we're seeing that capacity from Orano, the intention to ramp that up. If Orano reaches its full 15,000 tons of uranium capacity, it would result in an extra 9.1 million pounds of uranium demand coming into the market. You have Chemical Support Hull Facility, who is targeting an increase from around 11,250 to 12,000 annually by the end of this year, which would add 2 million pounds. And beyond that, the big one will be Honeywell's Comfordyne. If they can increase their capacity from 7,000 tons of uranium to 15,000 tons of uranium equivalent annually, this would generate 20.9 million pounds of additional uranium demand, and it would help clear a lot of these bottlenecks. So basically what we're seeing right now is we're seeing the West really invest a lot of capital and invest a lot of effort to try and solve these bottlenecks, to try to become more energy independent. And I think what we will see this year is a clearing of those bottlenecks, an increase in demand, a start of a replacement rate contracting cycle, and lastly, and then I promise I'll stop talking, is a inventory restocking cycle as well. Because in a bifurcated and uncertain market, what you will see is that these utilities in the US, they usually hold, or they try to hold 2 years on average, and in Europe they try to hold 3 years on average. I mean, these utilities, with all the certainty from the political, monetary, and public front that they're getting in the Western world right now, I think that they will be looking at their balance sheets and saying, okay, we need to make sure that we have these shock breakers in place for that if the bifurcation continues as it is right now, and if these fragile supply chains continue to be unreliable, that we at least have enough nuclear fuel in the pipeline to make sure that we keep this huge piece of baseload energy infrastructure that is trading at a premium, to keep that running at any given price. So I think we will see a replacement rate contracting cycle. I think we will see an inventory restocking cycle on top of that. And I really look forward to playing that with the uranium sector this year. And I think that that right now we see a good opportunity. And I look forward to writing a lot more about the sector this year.
Yuri, here at the tail end, can you give us any insight into how listeners and investors can kind of try to capitalize and monitor what TAMA ETF's Volt ETF refers to as the emerging power mega cycle? And on top of that, where can people just learn more about TAMA and your strategic ETFs as a whole?
Yeah, thanks much, Nicholas. And I just want to thank all the panelists for a really insightful conversation, appreciating, I guess, the risks and opportunities that lie ahead for what I hope will be a nuclear renaissance in many ways. I think from our perspective, we look at this space very carefully. I think there's a broader electrification mega trend going on. The reality is power demand is going to outstrip supply. And this is creating, by the estimates of the US regulator, almost a 40 gigawatt gap over, you know, not that long of a period of time between demand and supply. And all parts of the electrification value chain, from generation, distribution, transmission, have to be upgraded. And in many ways, this is estimated to be a $1 trillion opportunity. Now, the utilities will have to pay for it, the consumers, the factories that are being built in the US reshoring trend. And what Volt tries to do is find the most interesting opportunities across equipment, nuclear, the providers, the utility companies within this electrification value chain. We really like nuclear as a place, but as I said, we're taking selective risks because there are a lot of risks in terms of technology. We think that the policy dynamic is going to be positive, and that's the backdrop for the fund and the simple sort of elevator pitch. And if you want to learn more, you can head out to TEMA ETFs, TEMAETFs.com, And there under the Vault page, we've got an interesting article as well, and you can learn more about the fund and the stocks that we have in there. The fund is managed by a veteran investor who's been doing this for 30 years, investing across sectors, but particularly with an interest in the energy and electrification equipment space. And what we, you know, we really think this kind of approach is necessary because history is littered with lots of examples of excitement that then turns into ruin for a lot of investors. So you have to be careful and watch where you put your money. And we think hopefully the Vault Fund provides that kind of risk management approach to investing. And you know, we've written a piece recently just kind of outlining the electrification opportunity in the US and the drivers of demand. And in many ways, it's a kind of a secondary derivative of other big mega trends going on. AI being one, but electrification, shoring, mobility and electric vehicles, and also cryptocurrency and its kind of use cases. And but you're getting that with kind of classic good quality businesses that are selling electrical equipment, that are helping invest in the value chain across generation and transmission and distribution. So yeah, again, the ticker is VOLT, and you can find lots of information on our website and watch, you know, I encourage you to subscribe, and we'll be putting more and more material out, both across our Twitter channel and as well as on our webpage about the fund and the space.
Definitely do that, folks. And those of you who have been listening for a long time know that we have had several panels with Yuri. And so I can't thank you enough, Yuri, for not only sponsoring these panels and making them possible to get this information out, but also participating yourself, giving us your vast knowledge and expertise on this myriad topical structure that we have with these panels. I really appreciate you and your time. Have a great rest of your day, everybody, and thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us today.